The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, lawyers, guns, and marijuana. The Supreme Court is currently considering the case of U.S. versus Hamani. Ali Daniel Hamani is a Texas man who was arrested by the FBI in 2022 for possession of about 2 ounces of marijuana, 4 grams of cocaine, and a handgun. Federal law prohibits people who are addicted to or habitual users of illegal drugs from possessing firearms. The question before the court is whether, in this case, that law violates the Second Amendment of the Constitution regarding the right to bear arms. The court heard oral arguments on the Hamani case on Monday, March 2nd. Let's hear a bit. First, on the side of the government, here's Sarah M. Harris, Principal Deputy Solicitor General at the Department of Justice. We'll hear her opening argument and then a few minutes of questions from the justices.
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the Second Amendment does not prohibit the government from temporarily disarming habitual marijuana users while they persist in using frequently. That tailored restriction easily fits within the historical tradition of disarming categories of people who present a special danger of misuse. That is no license for Congress to deem anyone dangerous. The government must show a historical analog that is relevantly similar in why and how it restricts Second Amendment rights. Here, that's habitual drunkard laws. Under historical vagrancy and civil commitment laws, habitual drunkards were imprisoned or confined without specific dangerousness findings, based on judgments that habitual drunkards as a class threaten public safety. Surety laws require them to post bond or be jailed. Like 922G3, those restrictions reflect public safety concerns about the dangers of frequently using intoxicants. And 922G3 is less restrictive. Habitual illegal drug users can regain their arms through their own voluntary conduct by not using illegal drugs so often. Upholding 922G3 would not open the door to disarming weekend beer drinkers. Unlike alcohol, illegal drugs are illegal. They're illegal because Congress deemed their use dangerous at any level, and their dangers extend beyond their mind-altering effects to the risks of the illegal drug trade. Unlike alcohol, Congress and the executive branch have made specific determinations about the dangers of illegal drugs. And unlike alcohol, robust post-ratification history supports disarming habitual illegal drug users, not just frequently intoxicated users. Respondents' contrary approach that no habitual drug users can be disarmed would invalidate 922G3 and parallel state laws, even for habitual heroin, ketamine users, and would replace the Bruin-Rahimi framework with a discredited law trapped in amber approach. I welcome the court's questions.
Ms. Harris, the drunkards weren't the only one included in these sorts of statutes. What was the public safety concern about those who using subtle crafts, juggling, unlawful games or plays, feigning themselves to have knowledge of physiognomy, palmistry, or pretending that they could tell fortunes?
I'm glad you asked about the vagrancy laws. The vagrancy laws did cover those categories of people. They covered multiple concerns. They covered both people whose disorderly conduct presented a risk of public safety, and that's usually the mentally ill and habitual drunkards, and people who are essentially transients who are considered a threat. I don't think it's a problem that that type of law covered multiple purposes or categories, or the court would have had to also throw out the surety laws in Rahimi, which of course covered a much broader swath of conduct, including whoremongers, nightwalkers, all sorts of other categories of people. I think the fact that there's an overlapping set of categories of vagrancy laws, civil commitment laws, and surety laws that are all singling out
habitual drunkards. So would you argue that it's okay to impose a ban on homeless people who are not drug addicts but just merely homeless? Because vagabonds?
For Second Amendment purposes, no, we don't think so. And here's the difference.
And why is that?
Yes, I think the difference, two things. One is the point with respect to the specific application here, and two is a methodological point about Rahimi, I think. So here's the reasons. Being homeless is not itself a crime. Being homeless is not, at least in many there are things additional to it for due process purposes. It is not unlike illegal drug usage, something associated with the public safety concerns historically. There is not a robust post-ratification history the same way. These are the kind of constraints you'd look at. On top of that,
the danger of habitual alcohol users was not merely the fact that they were using an intoxicating substance. The way habitual was defined was that the state of intoxication didn't permit you to have a regular life. All the definitions around habitual alcoholics centered around not merely taking the drug, but the potential effect it had on you because you couldn't control it and would continue to use it. You were acting responsibly towards your family. You were sleeping in the streets. You were doing other things that showed that it incapacitated you. Now, it's hard for me to see how, given that drugs affect, there are different kinds of drugs with different kinds of effects, different kinds of duration. We have the illegal ambient user who shouldn't be using the sleeping drug but is. We have a marijuana user that you say regular is defined by two or three or every other day, but how about the marijuana user who uses it only one day a week and not in their home where the gun is? I mean, there was a definition and a situation with habitual alcoholic users that's different than this.
So 2 points. One with respect to the historical definition of habitual drunkards, and two with respect to why I think that 922G3 is more tailored and easier to justify than modern-day regulations. Habitual drunkards as a category were defined certainly for civil commitment and vagrancy purposes. There were no individualized dangerousness findings. It was a sort of judgment made often by magistrates or justices of the peace as to whether someone's conduct was frequent and putting them in the status of a drunkard. So habitual did mean frequent or regular. The drunkard piece is what does the work, I think, in a lot of your questions with respect to the level of intoxication. Second, why I think it's not a problem that there is translation of that level of intoxication for habitual drunkards to illegal drug users here. I think 922G3 is a lot more tailored. There's no, like, founding-era breathalyzers to tell you exactly how intoxicating things are. For 922G3, what's happening is you have, first of all, a restriction that is tailored and temporary and less restrictive because it is tailored to how often you're using it within your control.
Well, Ms. Harris, second, on that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to, before we lose track of what Justice Sotomayor is talking about, One can ask whether the habitual drunkard statutes are sufficiently — the how and why is sufficiently analogous. One could also ask, though, more basically, whether this defendant would qualify as a habitual user. And I want to explore that before we lose track of it. Habitual drunkard, the American Temperance Society back in the day said 8 shots of whiskey a day only made you an occasional drunkard. We have to remember the founding era, if you want to invoke the founding era. To be a habitual drunkard, you had to do double that, okay? John Adams took a tankard of hard cider with his breakfast every day. James Madison reportedly drank a pint of whiskey every day. Thomas Jefferson said he wasn't much of a user of alcohol. He only had 3 or 4 glasses of wine a night, okay? Are they all habitual drunkards who would be properly disarmed for life, under your theory?
No, and again, I think this is something —
okay, if they're not, then what do we know about Mr. Hamani? We know he uses marijuana a few times, about every other day. That's all we have in the record, right?
That's all we have, and
okay.
I'm not troubled by
it. So we don't even know the quantity of how much he uses every other day. What if he took one gummy bear with a medical prescription in Colorado? Well, you may not even need a medical prescription. You don't even need that anymore. But let's say he had one to help him sleep every other day. Disarm him for life?
Well, we're not — no, it's not disarm for life. And here's what's going
potentially
on.
Potentially. Would that be enough under your theory? One gummy bear every other night with a medical prescription?
So I think you'd have a Rahafe potential Rahafe problem, but I will accept the hypothetical. So let me just deal with what's an unlawful waiver.
I think the answer is yes, under the government's theory.
Yes, under our theory, but let me give you an explanation of two parts of this that are important. One, you asked about how do you tell who's an unlawful user? How is it more defined than a habitual drunkard? I think it's a lot clearer.
Is it? I mean,
yes.
The government has not been able to define what a user is. I mean, it is said at various points that it's someone who's used any illegal drug in the past year, right? It said ATF now wants to say a pattern, and you argue for habitual, which of course conflates the second half of the statute, which talks about an addict, which is different than a user, and an addict is an habitual user, it's defined as. So you're kind of conflating the two parts of the statute there. So tell me how it's so clear.
Okay. A couple of things to help you with this. One, I'm going to set aside the forfeiture issue, but I would like to return to that later. Just deal with the substance. With respect to who is an unlawful user, the Court of Appeals are uniform in adopting the same view as us, which is a habitual user in context.
But the ATF disagrees.
No, apparently. They absolutely do not.
They say a pattern.
Let me be very clear about the distinction here. There is a distinction between what is the statutory definition of an unlawful user, and everyone has always agreed, including ATF, that that means habitual or frequent. And on the other hand, how do you prove that? What type of evidence is sufficient to show beyond a reasonable doubt, or for purposes of background checks for ATF purposes, that you in fact do that?
So, okay, that, so that is a discrepancy. Okay, so that circles us back down to you would qualify as an habitual user, one gummy bear every other night.
Absolutely, and here's why. The check on that sort of situation is twofold. One is you have to know that you are using an unlawful drug. So if you're using your gummy and you don't know that it has THC in it or there's something else, you could have a nice Rahafe defense. But setting that aside in terms of other guardrails, illegal drugs are different from habitual drunkards in an important way. First of all, there is robust post-ratification history that I think shows that there is a tight connection between someone who is a habitual drunkard.
So if it all boils down to illegality, what do we do with the fact that marijuana is sort of illegal and sort of isn't, and that the federal government itself is conflicted on this? It doesn't enforce it quite the same way it does with respect to drug laws with respect to other drugs.
So two points. One, it's not just illegality, but with respect to illegality, I don't think the government is of two minds. The government is considering rescheduling marijuana as Schedule 3 to facilitate potential medical applications, but the government is not saying that it is not illegal anymore simply because states are not following federal law. I think the fact that the Controlled Substances Act is involved, it brings this not just in terms of the category of illegality, but into the realm of how do you test the fit? How do you test if Congress is, like, prohibiting chewing gum or caffeine on the one hand, legal substances, versus substances that actually do have intoxicating, mind-altering effects?
Okay, but Ms. Harris, one of the difficulties that I think is, and this kind of takes Justice Gorsuch's question one step farther, is in this case, I know we're talking about marijuana, but obviously the statute applies more broadly to other things that are scheduled, some of which can be taken lawfully or unlawfully. I take it you're saying marijuana can never be lawful because it's on Schedule 1, and even if it's on Schedule 3, the government's saying it wouldn't be lawful. Justice Sotomayor asked you about someone who takes Ambien to sleep. So let's assume that someone takes their spouse's Ambien prescription. The spouse takes it, too, lawfully with the prescription, but then, you know, you take it unlawfully because you break into your spouse's Ambien jar. So I take it that the one would fall under G3 and the other who had the prescription would not, right?
That's correct, because for one, it would be illegal. And then there's sort of ancillary questions about the use by one of habitual drugs.
Okay, but I guess my question is, I agree with you, and I think this is what Rahimi says, that legislatures can regulate to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. But when I look at this statute and when I look at what the qualifications are for being listed on one of these schedules, they're all about public safety, you know, they're about reducing addiction. And the example that I just gave you about the Ambien is important to me because it's not the drug itself in this circumstance that's causing the dangerousness. It couldn't be, because if my husband has a prescription and I don't, what is it about Ambien itself that would make one of us more likely to be dangerous? It's not. It's the lawfulness. And so too here with the marijuana, I just don't see anything in the scheme that actually reflects Congress's judgment that this makes someone more dangerous.
Okay, let me help on a couple ways. One is, I think that there's two parts of this. One is the fact that the Controlled Substances Act scheduling scheme does consider the long-term effects of use, I think, is important. I think that is important because it does reflect a determination that, especially if you are regularly and routinely using these illegal drugs, there are serious side effects. I would point you to the Third Circuit's Harris decision when you look. If you think that there should be a more tailored assessment of who is dangerous, their questions are replicating the very questions that are being answered through the Controlled Substances Act regime. And second of all,
the Third Circuit's not Congress, and nothing about the scheduling process suggests that the Attorney General or his delegee has to make a decision that a drug, that the psychological effects, I agree with you, everyone would say that any drug can have long-term psychological effects. But there's no indication that that's what was motivating the Attorney General or Congress. This just wasn't about — the Gun Control Act just wasn't about dangerousness. It wasn't something that the legislature thought it needed to consider then.
That was Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett. In that segment, you also heard Justices Clarence Thomas, Sonia Sotomayor, and Neil Gorsuch. They were asking questions of Sarah M. Harris, Principal Deputy Solicitor General at the Department of Justice, at her opening argument in U.S. v. Hamani. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear the first part of the oral argument on behalf of Hamani. Here's Aaron E. Murphy, Esquire. Again, we'll hear the opening argument and then a few minutes of questions from the justices.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Murphy?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The question in this case is a narrow one. Can the unlawful user prong of 922G3 be constitutionally applied to Ali Hamani? The answer is no. In fact, it can't constitutionally be applied to anyone because the statute fails to provide fair notice of what makes someone an unlawful user of a controlled substance who can be stripped of their Second Amendment rights. But even assuming the statute could be applied to Mr. Hamani consistent with due process, it could not be applied to him consistent with the Second Amendment. The government reads the unlawful user prong to cover anyone who is engaged in habitual use of a controlled substance. But the only historical tradition it has offered is one of imposing restrictions on habitual drunkards. That entire line of argument rests on a category mistake, because the laws to which the government points applied only to habitual drunkards, not to habitual drinkers. Indeed, the whole point of the doctrine was to distinguish those who consumed alcohol frequently, but mostly in moderation, from those who so habitually consumed alcohol to the point of intoxication as to impair their ability to function even in whatever moments of sobriety they may have had. And that distinction was critical, as deeming anyone who regularly consumed alcohol a habitual drunkard would have given the government sweeping power to subject much of the populace to hard labor, guardianship, civil commitment, and incarceration. Now, to be sure, the habitual drunkard tradition may well support disarming people who are addicted to a controlled substance, which is, in fact, the dominant approach in the states today. And perhaps it could justify a categorical approach as to certain substances if the government is able to actually prove that a particular substance is, in fact, so addictive and dangerous as to make anyone who regularly consumes it akin to a habitual drunkard of yore. But it cannot support disarming someone based solely on the fact that he consumes a few times a week something that Congress has designated a controlled substance. I welcome the court's questions.
The government takes the view that, or seems to suggest that your argument boils down to a facial challenge on the statute.
We are making the argument that it is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Hamani. Some of the arguments that we make may mean that it is unconstitutional as applied to a lot of people or even perhaps most people, but we are not pointing to some deficiency in the statute that's not applicable to Mr. Hamani and saying that that's a reason to invalidate it. At the end of the day, we don't — I mean, my client just wants to see the decision below affirmed. Whether that's done on facial or as applied grounds is not of particular importance to us.
Well, I know your client just wants to prevail, which is understandable, but your argument, it seems to me, I mean, why doesn't it apply to any drug, whether it's PCP, methamphetamine, whatever? It seems that, again, to the extent that you're overriding the judgment of Congress and the executive branch with respect to the listing of particular drugs, I don't know why that same approach doesn't apply to any drug.
So we think the same principle should govern in with respect to any drug, but that doesn't mean that the statute is unconstitutional as to every drug. If you take the principle underlying his habitual drunkards. The concept that the statutes back then required is somebody drinking to such excess that they can't care for themselves or their affairs, that they've lost self-control, that they're posing a public safety risk. If you apply that, there are going to be some substances where it may be that pretty much anybody who uses them regularly.
We're going to assess those on a case-by-case basis and apparently on an individual-by-individual basis?
Actually, we are happy for the government to have two options. It can do it on an individualized basis, which is exactly what the statute contemplates as to addicted to. I mean, you have to engage in an analysis of someone's actual use to figure out whether they're addicted to a controlled substance. But if the government wants to try to say a particular substance is so categorically, you know, addictive, dangerous, that you can't use it regularly, okay. But it has to do that under the burden of proof that Bruin assigns it, of proving that the category it has identified maps on to that category of habitual drunkard. It's not enough to just come in and do APA, discretionary, government gets the benefit of the doubt review, because that's eliminating the burden of proof that
so
Bruin
assigns
the government.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't understand the determination in every case. But also for other examples, you know, the New Year's Eve example, you can't, you know, shoot a gun in New Year's Eve and all that, it does indicate there's some categories of use that were prohibited at the founding, whether it's habitual drunkards and in terms of the illegal use based on particular individuals or categories or geographic limitations. Like today, we don't allow people to bring guns in the courthouses, even if they can say, look, I've never used it unsafely. Similar types of restrictions. And you say, well, now those are going to have to be litigated on a case-by-case basis in every individual instance. Is this — and that's going to be hashed out in court. Is this drug one that's particularly dangerous or particularly addictive? And it just seems to me that takes a fairly cavalier approach to the necessary consideration of expertise and the judgments we leave to Congress and the executive branch.
So I want to be clear about two things. First, we are not saying — we're not arguing that the Second Amendment doesn't allow for categorical prohibitions. That is not our position. And we're not even arguing that Congress couldn't perhaps have categorical restrictions as to particular substances. Our core point is, if Congress wants to do that, then the government needs to prove, with its burden of proof under Bruin, not just that this was a reasonable determination supported by substantial evidence that gets past APA review with highly discretionary, we'll assume the government knows what it's talking about, that it has in fact identified the category in a way that maps on to the historical tradition it is in.
Well, Ms. Murphy, I don't understand what you just said. 922G sets out various categories of people who are prohibited from possessing a firearm. And I thought you began what you just — I thought you said to start out that a categorical approach is permitted. Is that correct? So — or are you saying that as to everybody in all of those categories, there must be an individualized showing when that person is prosecuted?
We accept that the government can take categorical approaches. I think you're going to have to look at each — any given prohibition and examine the history behind it to determine what categorical approach can be taken. But we are not here to suggest that the only time the government can ever restrict the exercise
of rights. Okay, so as to at least some of these categories, there's no right to an individualized determination under the Second Amendment. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I think that, you know, you could have a discussion in a case involving certain provisions about the need for as-applied challenges, some way to allow somebody to show that, you know, yes, you might have the category right as a general matter, but I am somebody who happens to be outside it. But I think that that's something you confront once you've determined that the government got the category right, which is the threshold question. Did they get the category right as compared to the historical tradition that they are in?
So I don't completely understand that. Must there be an individualized determination as to anybody who is prosecuted under any of the subsections of 922G? Yes or no?
No. That is not our position.
Suppose, Ms. Murphy, Congress tomorrow says, you know, we're afraid that this Controlled Substances Act is not really doing it for us in this area, so we're going to come up with a list of particular drugs that we want to be able to take away people's guns. And the first on that list, I'm going to say I don't know a lot about this drug. I'm assuming you don't know a lot about this drug. So what I'm going to tell you about this drug, let's just assume is the truth about this drug.
Fair enough.
So it's the drug is ayahuasca, and it's a very, very, very intense hallucinogen. And the episode lasts a very long time. But it's not, let's say, an addictive drug. You know, you can choose when to take it. But when you're in its grip, like, you basically, reality dissolves, all right? And I'm assuming that Congress has a good reason for saying when reality dissolves, you don't want guns around. So, but that to me, when you give the description of the historical analog, to me, that's going to fail your test. Should it fail your test?
I'm not necessarily. I guess I would say two things. First, obviously, we agree that you can be prohibited from carrying while you're taking that drug. But I don't
it's
think
not
it,
a,
I don't
it's
think
not
it
a
stops
question
there.
Of carrying. It's like, are, you know, there you are in your house. You have a gun in your house as well. So you're owning a gun, even though you use this drug, let's say, once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think that it would be a little bit difficult to show that really using that drug every few weeks is going to be enough to render you akin to the concept that the historical drunkard laws were getting at, which is that your consumption rendered you – we're not saying that you had to be intoxicated all the time, but your consumption impaired your ability to function, even your moments of sobriety. That's what the courts are talking about. They're asking whether – it doesn't have to be addiction. It can be addiction, certainly. But it could also be you're consuming so frequently that, you know, that's really all you do, and during the
yeah,
day you're
so
not functioning.
So it's definitely going to fail your test.
It may not. I think, you know, you'd have to look
on my facts,
what the lasting
will, right?
How lasting the impact is. But if a person is if what you're essentially saying is there's a substance that leaves a person impaired once every 2 weeks – but the other 13 days of those 2 weeks, they are perfectly fine. I don't think it's consistent with the historical tradition the government has invoked, just as I don't think that tradition would support incarcerating that person, subjecting them to guardianship, or committing them to a drug treatment facility.
Well, what if you personally – I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you're – I mean, the hypothetical focused on a particular time period, but I think it could be used every week, not just every third week or every other day. And, again, I think that's something with the judgment about that. You said that's going to be made in court.
And that kind of judgment gets made in court all over the country all the time in the hearings that are routinely held to decide whether somebody can be subject to things like guardianship or civil commitment because of their substance abuse.
Well, but they're made under the determination set forth by Congress and the executive in statutes. You don't — you know, if they want to categorize this particular drug as something that's dangerous, that's not enough for you.
Well, that's not enough for the types of civil commitment and guardianship laws the government's pointing to either. It is not enough to just walk into state court and say, this person sometimes uses a controlled substance, and then you say, okay, therefore we will commit them to treatment for substance abuse. There is a process that has been developed in courts that requires all sorts of individualized inquiries into the nature of someone's use and whether it in fact renders them a danger to themselves and others on a regular basis.
That was Aaron E. Murphy, Esquire, delivering their opening argument in U.S. v. Hamani. In that segment, you also heard Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes
for the Drug Truth Network. This is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.